Welcome, everyone, to the Asia Unbound podcast series. I'm Liz Economy, and this week I'm delighted to welcome Somini Sengupta, who is currently the UN correspondent for the New York Times and previously served as the Times bureau chief in New Delhi from 2005 to 2009. She's also the author of a terrific new book, The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. Somini, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
So the title of your book is The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. What led you to this title?
So The End of Karma really refers to the sentiment that I found again and again and again among young Indians who I spoke to. And that sentiment was that they were keen to make their own way in the world. They were not going to be bound by their past. They were born with one destiny, and they wanted to write another. And that is a really incredibly hopeful moment in a country like India that is so very young. But alongside that hope, there's also a great deal of frustration, a great deal of anger when aspirations are not realized. And so, hence, hope and fury.
So you call this group the Noonday Generation, and you say it's going to be a transformative generation. What about the generation makes it transformative?
So first, let me give you a couple of numbers. There are today 365 million Indians between the ages of 10 and 24. 1 million Indians turn 18 every single month. Not just for, you know, the next couple years, but for like the next 10 years or more. So we've got this incredible youth bulge. And the generation that I call Noonday's children are precisely this generation that came of age after the Indian economy opened up in 1991, slowly, very quietly, but inexorably opened up to the world, and that led to a great deal of change. In part, one of the main changes, psychological changes, I think, was this sense of aspiration, was this really boundless aspiration among the young. So that's what I try to tell you about in these stories of seven young men and women. They don't represent every single Indian. They certainly aren't from every corner of the country. But, you know, they're seven in 1 billion. And through their stories, you hear not only about their own challenges, but about the challenges that they pose to this vibrant, democratic country.
Right. So I want to come back to whether or not India structurally is ready for this Noonday generation. But let me ask you first to tell us a little bit about maybe one of the young people that you follow and what you learned from this person.
So I'll tell you about a young woman named Varsha. She is now 19 years old. I met her when she was 13 or 14, I believe. She is the daughter of what's called a presswala. Her family has a little stand in a prosperous suburb of Delhi, and they press other people's clothes. They bring it from the really lovely villas and condos in this suburb. They iron the clothes, and then they send it back home. And this has been her family's job. You know, it's been their sort of occupation to wash and iron other people's clothes for several generations. Varsha, the girl who I write about, not only doesn't want to be a presswala or a presswala's wife, she wants to be a police officer. She got it in her head that the best way she could serve her country was to be a cop. And why did she want to be a cop? Because when she was growing up, when she was 16 years old, there was this widely publicized attack, gruesome attack on a woman on a bus on a Sunday night. She was gang raped by a half dozen men, and she later died of her injuries. This was certainly not the first or only brutal gang rape, but it really set off a series of protests across the country. It really made young people, young women and men, really angry about the whole question of violence against women and how it is not taken seriously, how it is not prosecuted aggressively. And so Varsha was growing up while this transformative thing was happening in her country, and she figured that she would be a cop. She would help other girls like her. But of course, her dad had some very different ideas. He did not think it was such a good idea for his daughter to be a police officer. He was worried he couldn't get her married off if she followed that path. And so Varsha's struggle was really not only to, you know, stick to her dreams, to make something of herself, but to fight against the very cultural norms that keep girls down in a country like India.
Yeah, and one of the things I liked about that story was that at each stage, Varsha seemed to win out over her father. Her father somehow acquiesced because she did so well on her exams that she kept being able to progress one step further, it seemed, than her father had anticipated.
Absolutely. She kept pushing and being pushed back and pushing a little more and being pushed back. So her story is really not just a story about a girl who is trying to make something of herself, but it's really a story about a daughter and a father, you know, and a father being challenged to reconsider his values, to reconsider how he sees the role of women and men.
Yeah, and I think one of the really important things about your book is that you managed to capture the country, India, not only through the stories of these young people, but also by illuminating some of the deeper political and societal trends. And you raised the issue of violence when you were talking about Varsha. And that was something that surprised me, and I think might surprise many readers, is the sort of degree of violence in India, right? Political violence, sexual violence, ethnic violence, caste-based violence. It struck me, I don't know whether this was something that you focused on intentionally or just somehow emerged from the stories and through your eyes as you were living and working in India.
I think many of your listeners will be familiar with the violence that was present during the birth of India. Remember, when the partition of India and Pakistan happened during independence in 1947, that was just an explosive, bloody moment. Hindus and Sikhs moved east to what is now India. Muslims moved west to what is now Pakistan. There was just an explosion of communal violence between those two communities, and yet at the same time also incredible stories of people protecting each other across religious lines. But you've had several instances of communal violence in India that your listeners will be familiar with. So when Indira Gandhi, the former prime minister, was assassinated, she was assassinated by her Sikh bodyguard. And of course, that led to really a pogrom against Indian Sikhs in 1984. And then again, in the early 90s, you saw again a great explosion of communal violence over the Hindu rights campaign to build a temple where a mosque, a 16th century mosque, actually stands. So you've had these episodes throughout India's history, certainly of communal violence, particularly between Hindus and Muslims. I was very struck by the sexual violence, against women that I heard about from Indian girls and women. And I started exploring, you know, the data, and I didn't find any evidence that A, violence against women in India is greater than in other countries, or B, violence against women in India has gone up or gone down in India's recent history. What I did discover, kind of inconclusively, is that women and girls are not willing to put up with that kind of violence. They're not willing to keep quiet about it anymore, as they might have been a generation ago. And that's really the shift.
Right, and now their voices are being amplified by the internet. And you tell a very interesting story about the experience of a couple of young women and the internet. Why don't you share a little bit of that with us?
Yeah, I mean, because this is such a young country, right? I mean, you've got 365 million people just between the ages of 10 and 24. That alone, that youth bulge, will make India a really interesting place to watch for all of us in terms of what happens to the Indian internet space. And so the story that I write about two young women who were just on Facebook chatting with their friends, and they kind of unwittingly expressed a political opinion. I won't get into details, but one that really upset some people. And therefore, these two young women were suddenly dragged into their local police station and charged with a criminal offense for upsetting the sentiments of another community or, you know, potentially riling up communal tensions. And this, to me, really crystallized a very peculiar ambivalence that India has always had with matters of free expression. India has always been ambivalent about how much free speech should be allowed. It is a democracy, so it really can't squelch the opinions of its citizens, and it's a very opinionated citizenry. But at the same time, because of this record of communal violence, India's leaders have always been a little wary of people saying too much and upsetting one community or another. So the internet has just made this tension all the more pronounced. The story of these two women actually has a good ending, because at the end of their ordeal, which, by the way, really infuriated their generation, they just couldn't believe two young college students were being dragged into a police station and being charged with a criminal offense for expressing their political point of view, a very mild political point of view. So the good ending was that this law under which they were arrested, that was overturned by the highest court in the land, but the story isn't really over. Even this government continues to weigh how much free expression really there should be.
Right. And that's I think, an ongoing discussion really in every country. I think sometimes we might be a little bit surprised about India because, as you say, it is a democracy, but on occasion it seems to veer toward or tilt toward a little more constraint.
And that's what is so surprising about this issue in India. It does pride itself as being the world's most populous democracy. And so whatever its policies are going to be on an open internet or a constrained internet, it can't be China. You know, India cannot be China. That's not part of the story that it tells itself. So it's a very interesting kind of ambivalence that I think we haven't seen the end of this story yet.
So you see this youth bulge, this transformative generation, I think, you know, pushing a little bit on cultural traditions, pushing via the internet. What other ways do you think that India is going to have to accommodate this new generation of Indian youth?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I mean, I think there are three really main pushes that I've certainly witnessed from this generation. One is an economic one, right? So when you have this kind of youth bulge, when you have half the country, more than half the country is under the age of 35. So if 1 million Indians are coming of age every month, that means India has to create somewhere between 10 to 17 million jobs a year. So that's a really unenviable challenge for any country. It's got to create economic opportunities for young people, and it's got to prepare young people to take advantage of those economic opportunities. That means education, public health, and on those two things, India has not made very strong investments. So even as it stands poised to reap this so-called demographic dividend, it really hasn't prepared itself for this moment. So that's one. The second is political. A majority of the electorate is now under the age of 35. So politicians are just going to have to pay attention to what they want, whether that's economic opportunities, whether that's a free and open internet, whether that's laws against violence against women. You know, on all of those things, I think their political voice is going to be very important. And it's not going to be homogeneous. I mean, it's not like young Indians necessarily skew liberal or conservative. In fact, Prime Minister Modi, very much a right-wing politician, he has tremendous amount of support. He certainly did in the last election among young Indians. The third area I would just point to is the environment. I think increasingly as India urbanizes and young people move to the cities, air quality, water quality, all those things will become issues that politicians will have to deal with. So I would say in at least those three areas, young people will pose a real serious domestic challenge to India's leaders.
Yeah, well, I think India's leaders can take a look over at China and see what might happen if they don't begin to take the environment more seriously and begin to address all their environmental challenges. So let me ask you one final question. Your family left India when you were a young girl traveling first to Canada, then to the United States, where you eventually settled in Southern California. Yet you would go back every summer, and eventually you became the first Indian to serve as the New York Times correspondent in India. What excited you most when you returned to India in that capacity, and what did you find most challenging?
As you rightly said, I would go back when I was a kid every three or four summers, and I would be, you know, very much cocooned in my family's home in Calcutta and very protected, and I only knew a tiny little piece of India. So when I went back as a journalist, of course, I had to discover and learn about this vast, very complicated, super interesting country that was never short of stories. But I also, as many Americans do, you know, realized that I was very much an American. So I was very much an American abroad. I wrote this book in large part to understand not only the country that made me as a daughter of India, but also the country that made my daughter. My daughter was born in India when we were there. And, you know, this is a snapshot of the time and place that made her. So in that sense, I have a lot of emotional stakes in this.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to share your ideas and your experience. The book, again, is The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Youth.